Next case for argument, United States versus Newsom, Mr. Marsh.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Counsel for the United States. My client, Ernie Newsom, is serving a 27-year sentence in federal prison based on contraband found in his home pursuant to a search warrant which did not satisfy the requirements of the Fourth Amendment. On July 26, 2002, a local Indiana police officer submitted a search warrant affidavit to a local Indiana judge which reported that this police officer had talked to a witness, Audrey, A-U-D-R-Y, Edwards, and Ms. Edwards had reported to him two facts. There are only two facts in the affidavit which bear upon the question of whether on July 26, 2002, contraband could be found in Mr. Newsom's home. The first fact was, the police officer said, Audrey, A-U-D-R-Y, Edwards told me that she saw child pornography on a computer in Mr. Newsom's home in July of 2001, at least a year before the affidavit was signed. Fact number two, the police officer reported that Audrey, A-U-D-R-Y...
No, we know how it's... I mean, the affidavit's right here in your brief.
It is, Your Honor, but...
The point is, I think, that an affidavit for a search warrant and search warrants themselves issue, the search warrant issues on probable cause, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt that something, that an offense has occurred. And the inference is being drawn from this second event, the one that she downloads with the help of the neighbor and gives the disc to the police officer, Sergeant Miller, that this man is collecting very suggestive material. Now, I'll say not pornographic, since it's simple nudity, but still of a young child, indeed her daughter. It strikes me as quite reasonable to say that this was probable cause, or at a minimum, that the officers who executed the warrant reasonably thought they had a good warrant in a Leon sense. Because of the nature of this activity. There used to be the pornographic material. Now we have current evidence that this type of thing is still being collected. The names do seem to be a little volatile, that we have a five-year-old, you know, the picture of the five-year-old and the 11-year-old appears to be in a picture. It's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but that's not what we're looking for.
Your Honor, with all due respect, the statement which you just made includes many facts that are not in the affidavit.
I'm looking at the affidavit. Your Honor, she took a CD-ROM that contains a video of what appeared to her and appears to Sergeant Miller to be a hidden video camera in the bedroom of Ms. Edwards' daughter. The video shows various things. We've just had a statement that the 11-year-old daughter, with obviously the name symbolic stuff, you know, date of birth 10/16/90. Describes what's in the video, describes the old stuff. I mean, this one says what it says. The affidavit says what it says.
I totally agree, Your Honor, but the affidavit does not say that Ms. Edwards downloaded the images on the CD-ROM from a computer. It only says that she took a CD-ROM out of the home. The affidavit does not say that the images on the CD-ROM are Stephanie Edwards, who was 11 years old. The affidavit says they are Audrey, A-U-D-R-E-Y, Edwards, age unknown. So the trial court...
But Ms. Edwards' daughter, I mean, I don't know.
Someone reading it would just assume these were all children.
Don't
you think?
They may, but I would suggest that violates the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment does not allow the judge to assume facts. That's the whole purpose of the judge making the probable cause determination, is to determine whether there are facts in the affidavit.
But why would the informant be concerned if I mean, she's obviously concerned about the children being photographed. Why would she be concerned if this were an adult woman being photographed? Why would that provoke her to call the police when she hadn't done so the first time? I mean, I think the logical inference from reading the affidavit would be that she became concerned enough to go to the police because this is recurrent behavior on his part.
Now, there's no question about what the woman was concerned. Her daughter...
And it's because it's her daughter. I mean, we don't know who the July 2001 pictures are of, but we do know that what she sees in July 2002 is this picture of her daughter in a state of undress.
It is her daughter. That is the only thing that we know. We don't know whether the daughter is a minor. We don't know whether the...
But the natural inference is that it's the daughter, date of birth 10/16. Actually, she's not all that old. You know, 4/26/65.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I disagree. That's not the natural inference. Because the facts in the affidavit state otherwise. It says that Stephanie Edwards is 11 years old. Audrey Edwards is presumably a different person, A-U-D-R-E-Y, age unknown. The affidavit does not state where Audrey Edwards lived or has ever lived. It doesn't state where her bedroom is or ever was. It doesn't state where this, what appears to be hidden video camera is. There are no facts from which the magistrate or the judge could have inferred that this camera was in Mr. Newsom's home. All we know is that when Ms. Audrey Edwards was in Mr. Newsom's home about 10 days before she went to the police, she found this CD-ROM and she took it with her. There's no evidence in the affidavit that states that there was a computer in Mr. Newsom's home. There's no evidence that states that Audrey Edwards had ever been or lived in Mr. Newsom's home. The whole conclusion of probable cause, or for the conclusion that there's a substantial basis that there's probable cause, is based on assumptions. And the warrant clause really serves no purpose if probable cause can be based on assumptions. So we may as well let the police officer just go on his own assumptions. So the facts just are not there to support the proposition that there is probable cause.
Now, what about the grouping? Well, maybe you could explain your argument about why it was improper to group. And in particular, am I correct, there are two Jane Doe 1 groups?
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, at the time of the sentencing hearing, evidence was introduced that there were actually three video images that Mr. Newsom had produced. Two of those images were of Jane Doe 1, and the third image was of Jane Doe 2. Each of those was treated as a separate group for purposes of the grouping guideline.
I take it your problem is that with respect to Jane Doe 2, this is uncharged conduct on production. Jane Doe 2, it's just a possession charge, right?
It's actually uncharged. The production is uncharged conduct with respect to the second Jane Doe 1 video.
But there is uncharged conduct on production with Jane Doe 1 on one of the points. But maybe this is just a labeling problem, because maybe, in fact, of course, for the possession with respect to Jane Doe 2, there's a cross-reference in the guidelines anyway over to the production. So why isn't this properly a possession Jane Doe 2, a production Jane Doe 1, and a receipt, three groups? In other words, why isn't your argument amounting to just a criticism of the way the judge got to a correct result?
Well, first of all, the way the judge did it was incorrect, because the uncharged conduct gets grouped only if it's part of the relevant conduct, and there's no evidence that the second Jane Doe 1 and the Jane Doe 2 images were part of the relevant conduct, namely evidence that they were prepared during, in preparation for, or in an attempt to avoid detection for the charged conduct. In terms of the cross-reference, both of the uncharged groups were committed on dates prior to the date of the habitual sex offender that was put into effect. Even if it's a cross-reference, Your Honor, it's not a group for purposes of the grouping.
Well, I'm just saying, if you have one set of offenses dealing with the possession, then the penalty for that is derived from the cross-reference under these circumstances. and then you have one with respect to the various receipt counts.
And that was done here, Your Honor, in terms of the cross-reference. The offense level for the possession count was set at 27, which is the offense level for the production. But that doesn't create a separate group under the grouping rule.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Marsh. Ms. Hillard?
May it please the court and Mr. Marsh, my name is Gail Hillard, and I represented the government throughout these entire proceedings. For issue one, this court will engage in de novo review. The detective used the wrong name in the affidavit. It was inadvertent. This affidavit had poor draftsmanship problems similar to the affidavit that this court decided and discussed in the case of United States versus Gary. The state court magistrate made reasonable inferences, however, and this affidavit still set forth probable cause to search the defendant's house for evidence of possession of child pornography.
Now, do you think there would have been probable cause if it had just been the fact that it had been weighing on Ms. Edwards' mind for a year that she had seen these materials back in July 2001, and she finally decides 12 months later in July 2002 to go to the police?
There would have been more.
Or do we need these events in July 2002?
The events in July 2002 give a very important context because they show that she took a CD-ROM.
Well, I agree with that, but I'm saying suppose they weren't there. Suppose all of these flaws that Mr. Marsh has pointed out were enough to say, you know, it's just too messy with respect to the July 2002 things. Are you agreeing then that it's too stale somehow to rely on the 12-month-old information?
It's more stale, and it's more stale, but in July 2001, she still knew that he had a computer, which implied important things like that he stores his images and they're important.
July 2002, though, it doesn't say anything about computers.
It does say CD-ROM, and that's
you could have a house full of CD-ROMs and no computer.
That's true.
How do we know he has a computer from the search warrant affidavit itself?
We don't know that he has a computer from July 2002, but knowing that she saw images on his computer in 2001 and knowing that she still takes a piece of computer storage media from 2002 does reasonably imply that he still has a computer. It also implies that he cares enough to store his images. And the fact that in July 2002 she sees a hidden camera image of her daughter reasonably gives the inference to the state court judge that he cares enough to transfer one storage media, that is the hidden camera, onto a computer storage media so that he cares about it and he collects it for long periods of time.
Well, I thought she's the one who actually made the... I know that's not in the warrant, but how can the judge know who made the CD-ROM? How do we know that he made it or some other person who's in the house some of the time or she made it?
At the time of July 2002, the state court judge didn't know. He knows that a CD-ROM is brought to Detective Miller.
Let me ask you about another. I'm curious about the length of the sentence, 324 months. What does a big-time child pornographer get sentenced to?
Our district had...
Aren't you worried about marginal deterrence? I mean, if a person like this, who's an amateur, gets 324 months, what do professional child pornographers get?
The government doesn't see this as an amateur. Mr. Newsom had...
No. But surely there must be... I mean, child pornography is an immense industry, I assume. So surely there are bigger fish in this pond than Newsom. No?
Mr. Newsom is a pretty big fish.
It's reassuring in a way, but aren't there people producing child pornography for distribution over the Internet and
yes.
so on?
Yes, there are.
Well, do those people get punished more severely or less severely?
It depends on the charge that they are charged with, Your
Honor. What is the rationale? We usually think that more serious crimes, setting aside the problems of detection, should be punished more heavily than less serious crimes. So I'm wondering in what world a 324-month sentence for this guy fits in with the punishments for other people in the pornography business.
factors that we think are serious in our office are things like, does he have access to a child and does he take advantage to access? That is, somebody who's demonstrated a sexual interest in a child.
So what if someone has access to 1,000 children? He's in the child pornography business and he makes movies. Maybe he's a supervisor of a school and he's terribly abusing his power in that position. I think that's what Judge Posner is getting at. There are people who, you know, are making films, who are distributing them worldwide, in fact, over the internet.
They're shot while attempting to escape. So.
Yeah. It does seem to me that there could be people worse than Mr. Newsom, not to say at all that it's a good thing to abuse one's power over even one child, much less two or any other number, but is he really the worst?
He's not the most that anybody in our district has ever been sentenced for. He's not the worst conduct, but it's hard to go on the sliding scale of conduct. He had 8,000 images of child pornography and child erotica on his laptop computer. He had access to 2 children, including his daughter.
That's the point, the 2 children versus the 1,000 in Judge Woods. That doesn't seem to have any, that doesn't seem to mean anything to you, that difference.
Is it worse to molest 1,000 children than 2? I suppose so, yes.
You suppose so.
You're
doubtful about it, right?
Well,
you're not sure.
It is worse to molest 1,000 children, but it's also bad to film one child.
That's not the question. Of course it's bad. It's criminal. Yeah. The point is, where's your reserve extra punishment for the bigger offenders? I mean, if this fellow gets 324 months, what does the person who abuses 1,000 children get? Does he get 648 months?
If the evidence warrants that, then yes.
As I understand it, the judge sentenced them.
Correct.
Within the guidelines?
Absolutely within the guidelines. He gave...
Where do they top out for this kind of...
The way the guidelines were calculated... I'm not sure what the maximum was, but he gave 20 years for count one, and then
what's the maximum, precisely? What is the top of the range for child pornographers?
Statutorily?
Yes.
For this crime, he had 24 counts that he was convicted of.
You're not answering my question.
What are the guidelines for the maximum he can get for what he was charged with?
Is it life in prison? Obviously not the death penalty after Coker versus Georgia, what is it?
Right. Is the court asking what's the statutory maximum?
No, guidelines on this case, what would be the maximum he could have gotten?
I don't know off the top of my head. I know how they were calculated
in this
case.
What's the statutory maximum then?
20 years for count one plus 15 years
no,
for...
No, no. If you put everything together, what is the most you can sentence a person for? But you keep adding 20 years on, you could get 100 years?
That's very theoretical, and we all know how what the statutory guidelines are is theoretical to what the...
This is more than 20 years, though, right?
Yes, it is. It was added, plus 84 months was added on because of the counts of receiving and possession that went concurrent to it.
Can I ask you for a second about grouping, since this isn't really getting us anywhere? I found the judge's explanation impossible to follow, and the PSR troublesome in light of the fact that completely uncharged conduct can't be its own group. And so I wonder if you could walk us through how we got the groups we got.
The guidelines tell us specifically how to do this. Section 3D1.2.
The judge didn't explain, yeah.
Okay, Section 3D1.2 tells us that instances of child pornography are not to group. Section 2G2.4 tells us to cross-reference over to the production guidelines.
Right, but the charges are for possession and production with respect to Jane Doe 1, right?
Production, possession, yes.
Receipt, quite a few charges.
Correct.
And only possession with respect to Jane Doe 3. But the PSR, at least, doesn't divide it up that way, at least as far as it seems. It seems to think that production versus Jane Doe 2 is a separate group, even though that's never charged.
Right. The court found that the relevant conduct of the 2 instances of uncharged production, that's how we've been referring to them, the Jane Doe 1 that was uncharged and the Jane Doe 2 that was uncharged, was on the very same videotape that was Exhibit 1 in the trial.
But that you have to have separate... He's never charged, though, with
correct.
Producing. So are you arguing that we should change the law with respect to being able to group on uncharged conduct, or are you saying that there's another way of organizing what went on, not what the PSR said, and certainly not what the district court said, that would yield the same final number of 38?
What the probation department did was exactly right, though, because the count of possession was, in essence, calculated first. I mean, they went in order, but the count of possession really included all of the other charged conduct, 1 through 24, and then it also included the separate groupings for Jane Doe 1 uncharged, Jane Doe 2 uncharged. And I see my time is up, if I might finish.
Yeah, sure.
So each of those calculations got its own, each of those separate instances of producing got its own calculation and got added to the highest level.
So they grouped on uncharged conduct.
It factored in one level for each of the uncharged instances. It counted in that Mr. Newsom was more blameworthy because the videotape contained...
No, but is there a group that has only conduct that's uncharged under the PSR? That's what I'm concerned about.
Paragraphs 55 through 71.
Right,
yes.
which is wrong because each group needs to, and then what you do with, you know, in terms of the charged offenses, there are cross-references, you can go to other guidelines, you can do all sorts of things to come up with the right offense level, but grouping, creating a group out of something that was never charged doesn't fit the law.
No, that is what fits the law because it's application note 2 of 2G2.1, and it talks about uncharged, and it talks about relevant conduct, which by its nature would be uncharged.
So application 2 is talking about you can't, you know, if you're talked to, if you have received or produced child pornography, and the indictment says you produced child pornography with two children, Jane Doe 1 and Jane Doe 2, that's going to be two separate groups because they're two separate victims. So you've been charged with both of them.
Right.
Application Note 2 doesn't suddenly go off and say you can have uncharged conduct.
No, but Application Note 2 also includes that it's specific to relevant conduct and each minor is to be counted separately as if contained in a separate count of conviction.
If that was charged, though, you're assuming count of conviction means charge, and I'm worried about bringing an uncharged conduct as a whole separate group. But anyway, we'll work through it.
Before you sit down, on page 25 of your brief at the bottom, you say Jane Doe 1 was unusually vulnerable and particularly susceptible to conduct because she slept while Newsom filmed her engaging in sexually explicit conduct.
Right.
Well, how could she be engaging in sexually explicit conduct when she was asleep?
I use that phrase because it's from 2256.
What sense does it make? How can she be engaged in sexually explicit conduct when she's asleep?
Well, she's engaged in a lascivious exhibition of genitals quite apart from her own behavior. She can't.
Well, what do you mean her own behavior? I mean, really, she's asleep. She's not engaged in sexually explicit conduct. That's a crazy way to put it.
Okay, well, that's just the definition from 2256. That's all I meant by that.
What are you thinking about?
Well, that's all I meant by that. Was
did he touch these girls when they were asleep?
He touched them in as much as he spread their vaginal area apart and their...
Well, your answer is yes. He touched them.
Yes.
Now, if he hadn't touched them, would you still be arguing that their being asleep had made them... If he just had filmed them without touching them, would you still be arguing that the fact they were asleep made them vulnerable victims?
Yes.
That would be ridiculous. Because when he's filming them through the peepholes, they don't realize, they don't know they're just as vulnerable then as when they're asleep.
Right. They're just as vulnerable.
Yes, you say it's because they're asleep that they're vulnerable.
Being asleep was an extra factor that the guidelines...
But you didn't say that being unaware of being filmed in the bathroom was made them vulnerable. Now, do you understand? There's absolutely no difference from the standpoint of the victim whether you're unaware of this filming because it's through a peephole or because you're asleep.
Okay, now, I apologize. Yes. I don't know how I would consider that question.
Well, I don't understand you why you don't know, because tell me what the difference is.
Well, there's probably no difference because...
Right, there's no difference. So the essential thing is that they were touched while they were asleep, which they wouldn't have been when they wouldn't, which they weren't when they were just being filmed through the peephole.
My argument is that they couldn't, she couldn't resist, she couldn't cry out for her mother, and those are factors that
but
would be the same.
But she couldn't do that in the bathroom when she doesn't know she's
right.
being,
so
right?
It
so
it's
identical.
It,
right?
It would be identical. If it otherwise fit the definition.
It's identical. Now, the question is, now, when the judge invoked this vulnerable victim provision, was it because he understood that they had been touched while they were asleep, or did he think that being asleep is a makes you vulnerable no matter what has happened?
I don't know, but I don't think it's because they were touched. Because they were touched made it more of a lascivious exhibition of guilt.
No, if they hadn't been touched, there wouldn't have been any relevant vulnerability. Because you don't take the position that not being aware of being filmed makes you a vulnerable victim. You think being asleep is something important. Well, asleep is important if the criminal wants to touch the person. But it's not important if the criminal just wants to film the person. That is exactly like being, you know, under surveillance without knowing it. Now, if you want to take the position that anyone who's being watched and doesn't know it is vulnerable, that's one thing. But you don't take that position. You think being asleep is vulnerability. And it's only vulnerability if it exposes you to being touched. So you'd want the judge, I would think, to say, yes, that's what made these kids vulnerable. They wouldn't have been vulnerable to a pure filming crime.
The factors that you have just enumerated certainly are the same as it otherwise meets the lascivious exhibition of the genitals. Just watching someone through a bathroom hardly ever.
So is this explained to the judge? Or did you just tell the judge, asleep, vulnerable, you know, QED?
Well, the court saw the videos in this case, and we argued
the court made up his or her own mind?
Yes, deferring to its own viewing of the videos, and her being asleep was something significant to him because she couldn't cry out for her mother. She couldn't. She didn't even know the materials existed.
You understand? That doesn't make any sense unless there's touching, right? So what did he actually say about that, about the sleeping?
I don't believe the court ever made touching part of its analysis.
But what did he say about sleeping? I mean, I'm looking at the judge's opinion. Page 28 of the appendix. He says, she is unable to express any kind of discontent and chance she has of avoiding these pictures or gone. This, of course, is true. Mm-hmm. But it's also true when she's being filmed through these peepholes.
It's true.
So what's the logic there? I mean, it makes the sentencing business seem completely arbitrary and mindless. Absolutely mindless. No thought goes into it. Just look at the guidelines and look at the words and come up with some number, but without any thought.
Oh, I believe there's a lot of thought that
we're going to be. Where's the thought about the sleeping versus the peeping?
Because this court looked at, not this court, the district court looked at this set of facts, and that's what was important to it, and the district court made a number of findings that would apply to vulnerable victim. I don't know how the court would rule if any of those hidden camera segments that we had, frankly, none of them meet the definition of 2256, and hardly ever do we have a case where if somebody's just filming somebody in a hidden camera mode, they just don't tend to meet that definition.
But you understand, the logic is the same. The person is not able to defend herself if she doesn't know that she's being filmed.
Your logic is true, and the court didn't make any specific findings that because she was touched. It's because she was sleeping and she was unable to resist, cry out, unable to defend herself. And that's what made her particularly vulnerable.
Okay, thank you. Okay, well, we'll move on to the next case. And you were appointed, were you not, Mrs.? Okay, well, we thank you for your services to your client. Last case for